Hello friends, and welcome to season 4 of the Anditz Records podcast. This is your host, Oisy Ronsberger. This season we will talk in depth about the reissue of the Shelter album, When 20 Summers Pass. This is the second part of my conversation with legendary straight edge icon Purcell, aka Paramananda Das. Today we'll talk about Shelter's breakthrough into the mainstream with the classic album Mantra, the immense pressure from the label when it was time to record a follow-up, and how it felt to get dropped after making too many compromises.
Mantra came out, and man, oh man, oh man, that record just exploded. The day that it came out, I'm pretty sure it sold something like, you know, it sound scanned in New York City, in just New York City, the first week, it sound scanned 5,000 copies.
Crazy.
You know, so I'm coming from a world where if you put out a record and then a year later you sell 5,000 copies of that record, that's a huge success. And here it is, we put out a record and in 1 week, we sell 5,000 copies just in New York City. It was like, wow, this is incredible. And then we played a couple of sold out. We played a show at Irving Plaza in New York City. It sold out. We had to play another one. That one sold out. And it was just like, wow, you know, things are really happening for the band. And then, of course, practically the first thing we did was we went to Europe, and one of the first shows we played was Dynamo in front of, like, I think it was like 92,000 people or something like that. We had never, ever, ever done anything like that before. We were on all these TV shows. We went to France. We were on a TV show with Green Day. It was like us and Green Day were the musical guests on some like French, you know, version of like Saturday Night Live or something like that. They picked us up in a limo and they drove us to the recording studio in a limo. You know, it was weird. It was weird. We went from overnight just being like this little tiny hardcore band to actually, you know, on like some of these main stages, you know, playing with pop bands, you know, playing with No Doubt, playing with, you know, Marilyn Manson and White Zombie and, you know, all these, like, you know, at the time were like huge, huge 90s bands.
So you come from that, you know, scene, or you already said you have that motivation, you know, you want to serve a purpose. Now all this outside influence comes in. There's obviously more money, there's fame, there's attention. Like, were you able to, you know, uphold your lofty goals and your spirituality, and or was that hard at that point?
You know, I think all things considered, I think we navigated it pretty well, at least for Mantra. I don't think we did such a good job later on, but I think that was more of, that was circumstantial, and we can kind of get to that later. But I think for Mantra, I mean, we were all still chanting for 2 hours a day. Even no matter what time we woke up, we would wake, no matter what time we went to bed, we'd wake up early, we would chant. We would take turns in the van giving Bhagavatam class. So every single day we would have class on the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the main book that you study in the temple. So we were still trying to recreate temple life as best as we could while we were on tour. And you know what? I think we had enough realization just from rubbing elbows with all these superstars that, you know what? It doesn't translate into any sort of deep sense of happiness. You know, because you meet these people who are like famous musicians and their life is a mess and they're drug addicts and they're alcoholics and, you know, the fame has gone to their head and you can just see that they're so arrogant. And, you know, arrogant people aren't likable people. That's the side of rock and roll that nobody sees. You know, a lot of self-destructive behavior, you know, a lot of drugs, a lot of drinking. And, you know, that lifestyle, it doesn't lead to like a happy, progressive lifestyle. So I think Shelter, although we had a lot of the glitz and glamour, we also saw the back end of that, and understanding that, you know, rock stardom and being in a huge band, that's also not going to make you happy. So I think it solidified our spiritual principles even more.
In around 96, I remember seeing an interview of a German TV show where you guys talk about, you've been on tour, you toured Mantra for 2 years now, and you're going home now, but you're going to film a video for Civilized Man, and you said it's going to support a vegetarian message. But that video never came out, right? Was it ever filmed?
It was never filmed. It never came out. I'm really bummed that we didn't do it. We were supposed to do it. There was all this talk about doing it with Roadrunner. But I think at that point, Mantra was already so old that they said, you know, because to film a video back then, I mean, that's going to cost you $30,000, you know, something like that, $30,000, $50,000. I mean, you know, it was outrageous the amount of money that we spent on recordings and videos back then. Yeah. And so I think Roadrunner just said, hey, instead of putting that money, in hindsight, it probably would have been smart to do it because Mantra was so hot even 2 years later.
Yeah.
But they decided, let's just work on new material and work on the and focus more on a new record.
Are you all still living in the temple together after the Mantra tour is over? Or?
I was the only one that was still living in the temple.
Okay.
Everybody else had moved out. And yeah, Ray had his own place. He was living in New York, in Brooklyn, not really too far from the temple, but I was a lone survivor living in the temple.
Was that a big thing for you? Like, did you feel like that the you know focus or purpose of the band shifted once some of you guys moved out or became householders, and the lineup changed?
You know, it did change in a way that I don't think it's necessarily evil. But, you know, when you start selling hundreds of thousands of records and you're playing these festival shows where you're getting paid like, you know, $50,000 for one show and you're touring year round, you start generating a lot of money. You know, we were actually making, I mean, we were making, if you had ever said to me that you're going to be making, you know, from music, you're going to be making, you know, well over, you know, $100,000 a year, just you, I would have been like, you know, that's crazy. But we started making like significant money, and that became attention. It became attention in the band. You know, I don't think it was a thing of people being necessarily greedy, but I think, you know, everybody, you know, before we were all just a bunch of monks living in the temple. We had barely any overhead. Like I said, all of our stuff felt, you know, all of our material possessions fit in a milk crate. We didn't need money. We didn't need money. But, you know, then people were moving out. Ray was getting married. You know, he bought a place and he had a mortgage. And, you know, everybody else was moving out. And, you know, in New York City, the rents are like, you know, just sky high. And everybody had big rents to pay. And, you know, then we had to start paying for our, you know, rehearsal studio, which is outrageously expensive. And I think, you know, people started, you know, we were moving away from our simple life and more into like, you know, a life when you get married and you're like, you know how it is. You have kids, you have your mortgage and you have bills to pay and you have people to take care of.
It gets complex. Yeah.
It gets complicated. It gets complex. And you have to start worrying about that. Like that one area of our life, money, where we never had to worry about any money we got, we just donated it to the temple. Now that for the first time in our lives, practically, it started to become a concern.
Yeah.
And I do think that that hindered the band a little bit at this point, for sure. I think at least created tension in the band for the first time that I had ever felt something like that, you know, in my life.
I mean, you guys, like, you never been in the situation. Like, how should you have known how to navigate that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I was, you know, even for me, I was living as a brahmachari in the temple. You know, brahmachari means you're a celibate student. You know, I was still waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, had a whole entire morning program. I had a lot of service to do, you know, not a lot, but I had service to do at the temple. But I knew that eventually I'd be moving out of the temple too. Like, I didn't see myself being a monk my whole life. Like, that's just not really me. I think, you know, and even in Indian culture, like, you know, brahmachari life traditionally means when you're a young man, when you're unencumbered, when you don't have a lot of responsibility, before you're married, you move into an ashram and you get some really serious spiritual training under your belt. And then when you turn, you know, 25 or whatever, you go out, you enter life, you get married, you know, you start your career, but you have that foundation of all those foundational principles that you've, you know, really lived for a few years. And that becomes your foundation that your whole life gets built on. And so I was sort of feeling that too, like I had done the temple thing, I'd gotten my training, and even though I wasn't moving out of the temple yet, and you know, at this point of Shelter's career, me living in the temple really didn't mean that much because we were literally on the road, you know, we're at 40 plus weeks a year. So just living in the temple, that meant that's where my milk crate was, you know, when I'm traveling around the world for 95% of the year.
What was the mindset when you started, you know, writing for Beyond Planet Earth? Because I also noticed that for the first time, you significantly, you know, there's a significant amount of songs that you contributed as a songwriter. Like, what was the mindset when you guys decided, all right, Mantra, we toured enough on it, now we're gonna start writing a new record?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we first started working on, and you know, we didn't know it was going to be called Beyond Planet Earth. Beyond Planet Earth was one of the last songs we came up with. But, you know, I started demoing some songs. I had like a little, you know, cassette recorder that I had at the temple on the balcony of the temple. And I used to just go in there and I used to write songs, you know, a little cassette. I would demo them. And so I had probably like, I think I had like 6 or 7 songs. It was the hardcore songs. It was, it became like Hated to Love and I Know So Little So Well. Some of those other ones that came out like super poppy. But when I did that demo, the songs were literally like twice as fast. And they were almost like, and they were like punk songs. They were like, I was, my thing is not, I don't come from a scene of pop music. You know, pop music to me is the Descendants. So that's where all my pop sensibilities comes from, like Descendants, Channel 3, you know, some of the early LA, you know, stuff. So I was writing stuff and it was very fast. It was melodic, but it was very fast and it was very kind of like upbeat and it was very punk. It's so, I was just thinking about this before because you sent me When 20 Summers Pass with a bonus track. And you said, hey, listen to this before we do the interview. So I listened to it and, you know, everything is so fast on it. And we had a bunch of like, and there's a lot of thrash songs on it. And that was sort of like the mindset of going in is like, okay, we've already established ourselves as like a heavy band, a fast band. You know, we had a bunch of like, you know, probably one of our most popular songs on Beyond Planet, on Mantra were the faster songs, you know, that would always, you know, go off live. So we were thinking like, yeah, we're just going to move in our strengths and we're going to like do that. The record label, you know, at this point in Roadrunner's career as a record label, they were getting huge. Like they went from being like this independent metal record label, like underground thrash record label, to have like with Typo Negative literally having gold records and a huge influx of money for them. All of their bands were getting, Sepultura was like the Metallica of South America. They were selling incredible amounts of records. Like they were like a huge band. And so Roadrunner itself was becoming like literally like a major label. Okay. I mean, they, you know, and so they wanted to have a hit. Like they wanted a legit gold record hit. It was a really weird time for the label because I think I touched on this, you know, on that Roadrunner podcast, but maybe not as much as I should have. All the people at the label that had really worked tirelessly for our band and pushed our band to limits that we had never been before, you know, just by believing in the band and being super fans of the band, most of those people left. They left, they went on, they got jobs at major labels for, you know, twice as much money, stuff like that. They moved in, you know, they moved their career paths into bigger and better things. So Roadrunner wanted to do that too. And basically they replaced all these like, you know, super passionate music people who had formerly, like when Mantra came out, the Roadrunner staff was, it was people that love music. That's why you work at a record label in the first place. You love music. But they decided they were going to try something different and they were going to try to compete with the major labels. And so they hired a bunch of professionals, people that didn't know anything about metal, didn't know anything about hardcore, people that had, you know, graduated from, you know, some Ivy League school with a marketing degree. And so that's what the staff really became. It became like a bunch of professionals, not even people that were particularly passionate about music, but supposedly these guys were, you know, business, hardened business people who were going to take Roadrunner and make them into like a major label kind of deal. Huge mistake.
Did you guys feel the pressure? Because the starting point seemed almost the same, right? You got Dave DeCenzo to play drums again, which was great.
Yeah. Originally, there was no pressure. There was no pressure. We had our groove. Mantra was really successful. We knew what we had to do. We were going to write songs like that. It was going to be, you know, melodic punk influenced by hardcore, and it was going to be heavy, and everything was going to be great. And like, that's like those songs that I demoed were kind of in that vein. Little did we know, like, here's the record label. They're retooling their whole entire organization to now be like, okay, we're moving into the big time. We're going to hire a bunch of, like, you know, big time people. We need a hit record. They're not going to get a hit record from Nail Bomb or maybe even, like, you know, Machine Head for that matter, you know, as great as Machine Head is. They're thinking our two best opportunities for having an actual legit hit record are Shelter and Dog Eat Dog. So they threw a lot of money at both those bands, and they really hung a lot of pressure on us. And the whole pressure was like, you guys got to write a hit song. You guys got to write a hit song. You guys got to get on the radio. You guys got to slow down. You guys got to move away from hardcore. You know, you guys got to move to a different level. And it was just like, and all of a sudden it's like, holy crap. Like, you know, there's all this pressure. Scrap doing what we're doing. Like, now we have to write a radio song and a hit song. And we're like, and I tell you, it completely threw off our game. And anybody that's in a band out there, never, never freaking do that. Never let other people set the direction of your music. It's got to come from you organically. You know what I mean? It's not like you can just be like, I got to write a hit. And it was literally, it was terrible. It was terrible because, you know, the music scene was so eclectic. It was the 90s. You had everything from like Nine Inch Nails to, you know, really poppy pop stuff. You had like Rage Against the Machine, which was almost like rappy rock. You know, it was like, it wasn't like one thing was big. You know, you had like No Doubt hitting it big with like ska influenced pop stuff. So it's like, write a hit song, write a radio song. It's like, there's not one sound that's on the radio. There's all these other, like, so it's so confusing. You're listening to the radio. And then I remember thinking like, okay, now we got to write a hit song. And I'm like listening to the radio and thinking like, oh my God, like, are we going to sound like No Doubt? Are we going to sound like freaking, you know, White Zombie also have a hit song? It's just like, you know, all these bands sound so different. What path are we going to take? And, you know, the crappy thing is, I think we tried to like kind of cover all bases when we were doing it and write like a really poppy song and then like a heavier kind of like White Zombie song. And it was just like, there was so much pressure to like write a hit song. And you know what? And you want to know what sucked too is, you know, unbeknownst to me and the rest of the band was, you know, Tom Soares was our guy. He was the guy that did Mantra. He was the guy that did Bringing It Down. We loved him. We knew we were going to go back in the studio with him. He was an incredible, incredible producer, incredible engineer. Like, he would engineer and produce. We loved him. He loved us. We worked together, you know, fantastically. He had had a hit. He had worked on a string of hit records. He did like New Kids on the Block. He did Marky Mark. He did a whole bunch of stuff and like had, you know, whatever, platinum records on his wall for engineering and producing all this stuff. So not only were we under a tremendous amount of pressure, the record label went to him and they're like, it's up to you. You're the engineer. We need a hit song. You've had hit songs. You have to take this punk band Shelter and you have to transform them into a hit making machine. Go. And so he was under a lot of pressure too, that I have to have a radio hit. Or else, like, you know, my job isn't done. It was a disaster because I had that demo and I brought the demo into Tom Soares. And he's like, all this stuff is way too fast. It's way too fast. You're never going to get on the radio with this stuff. And so we literally took those songs and we slowed them down to like half the speed. So they became almost like 70s rock songs or something. And we really tuned it down on like on the production, and we used a lot of like lighter guitar sounds, and there was all these other influences. Like, you know, there was no real cohesion to the record. We had like, Eleventh Day of the Moon, which is more like a just a straight up kind of like rock song. And then we had that like techno influence song on the record. And then we had really poppy songs on the record. And it was just like, you know, we had this freaking ska song on the record. Believe me, I was not down for that one.
Who came up with that? Did Ray write that one?
Ray came up with it, but I'm not even blaming him because he's the singer. He's under more pressure to come up with a pop song more than anybody. And, you know, so we had just came off on tour with like No Doubt, you know, No Doubt's playing ska songs. And, you know, every night there's, you know, 30,000 people screaming along with these ska songs. It's just like, shit, we got to write, you know, maybe a ska song. You know, and I tell you, we came up with that ska song and I was like, this is never going to end up on the record, you know, because you write a lot of songs. You know, whenever you do a record, you write like 20 songs, you pick the best 11 ones. And sometimes you don't even know which songs are going to end up good. Like, I had no idea Here We Go was going to turn into like the song that it turned into until we actually sat in the recording studio and recorded it. So you just have to keep an open mind most of the time until you get everything recorded. And then you'll see that things will start to fall into place, and you'll see songs will start to fall into place. And that's usually how that, like, a recording session worked. So even though we had this ska song, I'm thinking this song is never going to make it. But the record label was super into that song because they're thinking, oh, No Doubt had it. So they pushed us to no effing end to keep that song on the record and to work that whole song. It was just like, it was an outrageous amount of pressure. And you know what's so stupid? If you look back in the 90s, what was big was the stuff that we were doing anyway. Punk, Rancid got huge, you know, real like organic stuff. And like, if there was no pressure and they just said, go make the record you want, that record would have been way more popular than Beyond Planet Earth. You know, they should have just left us alone. They should have just left us alone. I really like, it was a lesson learned that never let a bunch of people who think they know better about your music try to influence you on what kind of music that you want to write. It's a recipe for disaster. And I think that's really what happened with, you know, although I think that, you know, Beyond Planet Earth, it has some moments.
You know, but I always say it has some of the best Shelter songs on it and some of the worst.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a half-half. It's literally, or yeah, 50-50.
And I'm really kind of bummed that, you know, the songs that I wrote, they really got like watered down and slowed down and like against my, yeah, at first I didn't want to do it, but then I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to just kind of trust in the process and just hope like this actually turns, you know, this actually works and we have a radio song. But I'm really bummed because I wish some of those songs were like, my original vision was to make them really kind of bouncy, you know, fast, super fast, but melodic punk songs, you know, and they just didn't turn out that way. And I wish we could turn back the clock, but you can't.
What was your feeling once you finished recording? I think you've been in the studio for 3 months or something, right? Something ridiculous.
We were in the studio for way more than 3 months. And, you know, even that's not good because, you know, we're used to having a pretty cohesive body of work already ready to go. And then we just go in there and there's, you know, little experiments that you do in the studio. But even when we started recording that record, it wasn't like Mantra where we had the songs fully written, ready to go. We had worked on them for years. A lot of them we had already played live. We had the bugs worked out with them. There were a few songs like, you know, Here We Go that Ray hadn't even written the words to yet. But by and large, it was a pretty well worked out record. But when we went into the studio, you know, there was like, that was another thing. It was like a real timeline. It's like, now you got to get in the studio. We got to get your record out by summer because, you know, that's when the touring cycle is going to hit. So get in the studio now. And, you know, we had barely gotten off tour. You know, we were just touring incessantly. And we got off tour and it's like, okay, here you have 3 weeks and you got to get in the studio, get your songs together, get in that studio. It wasn't enough time. And so when we went into the studio, a lot of these songs, they weren't even fully fleshed out yet. Ray didn't have a lot of the lyrics. So we ended up spending, forget 3 months. We probably spent like, you know, 4 or 5 months in the studio. We spent well over $100,000 on that recording that record.
Insanity.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. You know, I could have bought a house for the amount of money that we spent recording that record.
At that point, Ray already on the cover, he already grew his hair out. There's an earring here.
Yeah.
So he is obviously moving away from the very orthodox Krishna conscious monk life. As you said, he moved out of the temple. But did you feel there was like a spiritual disconnect between you and him at that point?
Not really at that point. I think later on it got a little bit more tense. But at that point, I think me and him at least were really kind of still very, you know, super committed to our spiritual practices and things like that. You know, we had gotten other people in the band. You know, Franklin was in the band. Franklin was also, you know, a devotee, so he was great. But we got the, you know, the drummer who was like this brand new guy who, you know, wasn't really into Krishna at all. And you know, so that added some tension to the band too. And then we would have a revolving second guitar player. We could never keep a steady second guitar player. So, you know, that was always troublesome also. And yeah, I think I don't think it was really anybody just kind of saying, I don't want to be a devotee anymore. Screw this Hare Krishna stuff. I think it was more of like, you're moving into a new season of your life. Like, you're not living in the temple anymore. You're not a monk anymore. Now you're moving into a new season. You're getting married. Like, you know, Ray was getting married. I actually, you know, I got married. You know, now money is a concern. Now, you know, taking care of your family is a concern. Now, you know, Ray, you know, when he, you know, he eventually, you know, married a woman that already had kids. So he had kids, you know, and I had a kid on the way and everything. And says, you know, it takes a little navigation to kind of get there. Mm-hmm. And so of course there's going to be mistakes and bumps along the road and a little bit of tension because it's like, it's just different territory that you haven't really traversed before. And so of course you're not going to do it well. You know, you're just kind of like learning how to do it well. So I think there was a lot of mistakes in that area. But you know, you live and learn.
Did you, like, what was your feeling when Beyond Planet Earth was finally finished and you put it out into the world? Do you still have hope it's going to take off?
No. I was super disappointed with that. I tell you, if it wasn't for me, the original idea for the cover was supposed to be a complete joke. The whole record was supposed to be a take on a Bollywood movie. And the cover was supposed to look like a Bollywood movie poster. And then the back cover was supposed to look like a Bollywood movie. And it was supposed to say Purcell as Patel. And like, we all had like Indian names, and it was sort of like, and you know, that's where, you know, they hired this big, you know, this big company to do it. And they came out with this whole, oh, we're going to do this joke thing. It's going to be so funny and people are going to love it. And that's like really where, you know, things are moving towards. You got The Offspring, you got Green Day, everything's very tongue in cheek. And so we're going to kind of like be very tongue in cheeky about this Indian spirituality. And I think even Ray was like, yeah, maybe we should try it. And I was like, no. I said, no. Like, this is, you know, I was still living in the temple. I was like, this stuff is my life. I'm serious about this. I'm not going to make a joke out of this. And I was just thinking, like, we always, like, Shelter was a type of band that had a certain integrity to us. And that's what gravitated people towards the band. There was some seriousness to the stuff that we had to say. And I didn't want to throw that away because some marketing guy at a record label is doing marketing analysis of the music scene. And he's got spreadsheets to say that these bands are getting popular with like joke songs. And, you know, this band should be a little bit more jokey with their cover. No, like even that, you know, even the cover, they still use that picture on the cover, that drawing, and even like the back cover, they still use some elements, and they use that terrible picture for us on the back cover. And the whole thing came out, and I remember getting the CD, and I remember thinking like, oh, this sucks. Like, I don't even like my own cover of the record. I don't even like the back cover, you know? So it was a big, huge disappointment from even the second that I got that CD in my hand. What to speak of even going on tour with it.
After all the hard work that went into.
Yeah, after months of hard work and the intense pressure, and even even our engineer and our producer being under intense pressure, like record, you know, hit song, blah, 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 you know, all the, you know, the people, you know, before we had the, you know, Howie, who was the guy that signed us, and he would come in when we were doing Mantra, and he was just super happy. And he was just like, you guys are doing great. This record sounds amazing. And then we had people come from the record label coming in like, where's the hit song? Like, what's going on? Like, we need a single. I'm not hearing any singles on this record. Like, you got to retool these songs. You got a bigger chorus on this song. It's just like, fuck, man, give us some breathing space, you know?
At that point, you had so many friends on major labels, right? Sick of It All, Orange 9mm, Into Another, Sandfield. Did you guys ever talk to each other about those things? Or did you kind of feel isolated in your own little?
We didn't really talk to them that much, but there was also, that's the added pressure too. All of our other friends are signed to major labels. Everybody's hitting it big. I'm sure those guys felt it too. I'm sure those guys were also pressured into, we need a song that's going to be on the radio. And it just doesn't make for good music.
No.
So yeah, I was pretty bummed with that record from the jump, I think.
And how were reactions out there? Like, did you get a lot of negative feedback at that point, or?
It definitely was not the super explosion like when Mantra hit. And, you know, it was really, it was like, you know, like I was talking about in that Roadrunner podcast, you know, because they had changed the whole entire staff of Roadrunner practically. And they got these quote unquote professionals in there. They didn't know what the hell they were doing. Like, we had Sue Marcus, who was a big Shelter fan, huge music fan, doing our publicity, and we had, you couldn't have believed the press that she got for us. Huge magazines, huge major articles. We were on the cover of like some of the biggest magazines. You want to know, and you know, we were doing interview at like the whole month's like working up into the Mantra release. It was like me and Ray's full-time job to go down to Roadrunner and do interviews. And we'd be at Roadrunner from the time they open to the time they close on the phone with magazines, with newspapers, you know, just doing all these interviews. They bring people in. We do video interviews. We were on TV. You know, all this stuff is like leading up to the release of the record. And so here's the record coming out. They hired this new publicist right out of college, this lady who didn't know anything about punk. I was like, what kind of music do you like? She's like, oh, I don't know. Like, whatever's on the radio. Like, she wasn't even passionate about music, but she just had a degree in marketing. So they hired her. And here it is, like, it's coming up, like, the week coming up to the record, and I'm like, I haven't done one interview. I'm like, Ray, have you done any interviews? He's like, I did one for a yoga magazine. And I'm like, what? The only interviews that we had done to work that record was one interview. It wasn't even for a music magazine. It was for a yoga magazine.
Crazy.
Yoga wasn't even big back then. I mean, yoga was just like a yoga magazine. Like, where do you even get a yoga magazine? You know what I mean? It was like, it was super, like, even that was disappointing. Like, even like there was no progress made to really set up that record in a really big way for success.
Yeah, I remember they had this weird ads in Europe.
I hated those goddamn ads.
You know the one I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's
yes,
Ray
yes.
on a surfboard surfing the universe, and the cover is a planet behind him. The Beyond yeah. Planet Earth cover is a planet. I was like, what?
And they made some really embarrassing promotional stuff. Like, they made, like, you know those like stress balls that you squeeze?
Oh yeah.
They made one of those that said Shelter on them, and it was in the shape of an Earth. I'm like, why are you wasting money on this? Like, this is ridiculous. Like, I don't even want this. Like, I'm embarrassed by this. Like, it was just it was a whole thing of just trying to like force yourself into the mainstream consciousness by doing things that you think are going to break you into the mainstream, when it's so forced and so inorganic that none of it worked. Everything about that was just like, it was already set up to fail 6 months before the record even came out. And really, it really sucks too, because I think if we just weren't bothered and we were just left to our own, we probably would have wrote an incredible record.
Do you remember when you guys got officially dropped by Roadrunner, or did you guys leave? Yeah. Or
No, we got dropped. I remember we had this management company called Concrete Management, which was a huge management company. I mean, they had like, you know, huge pop bands and stuff, and, you know, huge metal bands. I remember our rep there, Concrete Management, came to me and she said, we had healthcare through Roadrunner. Like, we were all the band, Roadrunner was a great label. Like, we actually had healthcare. You know, for the first time in my life, if I wanted to go to the doctor, I could actually go to the doctor and not have to pay out of pocket. So she came up to me and she said, if you have anything to go to the doctor for, or if you need any dental work, you should do it right now, because you guys are probably going to be dropped next month.
Crazy.
And so we were all like, oh man, I went for a cleaning at the dentist. You know, I like got a checkup, you know, got like whatever, you know, duh. But I remember she told us that we were going to be dropped.
Wow.
And quite honestly, I was really like super pissed about it. I was like, you know, here's this record label that did everything wrong. You know, and the, you know, the whole, you know, they should have done anything to hold on to that staff that they had. They should have doubled their pay deservingly, because those people were like incredible. They should have held on to those people with both hands, done whatever they could to keep those people, because those were the people that actually made the record label what it was. But they let all those people slip by because they got bigger offers from major labels. And then they hired a bunch of professional people that knew nothing about music or weren't passionate about music. Put a ton of pressure on us to write like a mixed bag record. And then of course, when the record doesn't good, they freaking drop us like flies. You know, I just felt like this is something that a major label would do. Yeah. You know, they don't care. If you don't have a hit, fuck you, you're dropped. Go back to the streets. You know, it was Roadrunner wasn't like that for Mantra. It was like a family, and they loved you, and they loved your band, and they believed in your band, and they really worked hard for you. And that wasn't the case with Beyond Planet Earth at all. And then we got dropped, and it was just kind of, it was a really kind of sad year for us, for sure.
Was that 98?
It was like 98, 99. I think I quit the band in, the band was still going at that point, but I quit because my wife got pregnant and my son was going to be born, and, you know, rightfully so, my wife said, yeah, I want you to quit the band. And, you know, rightfully so, because you can't have a kid on the way and be away the whole year.
But that's probably a little later, right? That's not around. Was that around Planet Earth, or did that happen after 20 Summers?
Oh, yeah. Actually, when did 20 Summers come out?
2000.
It came out in 2000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it must have been right. It must have been like pretty much a little bit after 2000, because my son was born in 2000. So it was probably, yeah, it was probably like after the first touring cycle of When 20 Summers Pass, and then my wife was just like, nah,
that's not gonna happen. Let's backpedal a little bit. So you're at that point, you get dropped, you know, all those dreams of the band, you know, breaking big, or, you know, getting bigger and bigger all the time. When did you guys decide to record 20 Summers?
Well, you know, after that tour, there was a lot of tension between me and Ray, quite honestly. I think we were just both frustrated with the band. We were frustrated with the record. We were frustrated with the record label. We were frustrated that the record wasn't doing well. And it caused a lot of tension with us. And I think once we got dropped, I think we just kind of like, I think we took a break from the band. I don't think we officially like broke up or anything, but we were just like, man, we just like need a break. I don't think we saw or talked to each other or did any shelter related stuff, you know, for maybe, for a long time. I think it was like a year or something like that.
Okay.
Where we were just basically like an inactive band. And at that point I had moved out of the temple. So we got dropped and I moved out of the temple. And luckily I had a ton of money, because I was living at the temple, not paying rent. I actually, like, we were barely paying, like, we would pay like a little kind of like whatever to the temple just for letting us have our own room. But then I was the only one left. So I was the only one left living in that room. So the temple president came up to me. He's like, I can't have you living in this room alone. Like literally 8 people can fit in that room. So he said, you're never here anyway. So I'm going to take this room back. And I said, okay, is it cool if I just, you know, keep my stuff here? And like, whenever I come back, I just sleep anywhere. And he's like, yeah, you can do that for free. I don't care. You know, come back, you know. And I was a brahmachari. For me, sleeping on the floor, it was just like, whatever. I would sleep on the floor if I had a room anyway. I just put my sleeping bag anywhere and sleep. So I used to just do that. So I wasn't even paying rent. You know, whenever I was home, which was only like a few weeks out of the whole year, I'd basically go to the temple. I'd sleep in a sleeping bag, you know, wherever I could. And, you know, I would do the morning program and, you know, do the whole stuff and do a little bit of service. But I wasn't paying any rent. I wasn't paying anything. And so all that money that I made from shelter, I just saved it. I didn't spend anything. I was a brahmachari. Like, what am I going to spend my money on? Like another dhoti? The only thing I would spend money on was like once a year, I would take a trip to India. And even that's pretty cheap because once you get to India, everything's like dirt cheap to, you know, for housing and food and stuff like that. So I was barely spending anything and just tons of money is coming in. You know, it was only fair that even though I was a brahmachari, that I would still get my cut of money because, you know, Ray is moved out of the temple and he's getting his money. It's not like I'm just going to like, whatever, donate my money to the rest of the band. I knew I was going to eventually be moving out anyway. So I figured it's probably smart if I just save a bunch of money anyway. So luckily Beyond Planet Earth came out, we got dropped. Everybody's frustrated. And I just figured this is a good time to just like move out of the temple. And I had like a huge, huge cushion to just kind of like move out, get a really nice apartment, not have to work, kind of figure out like my next step of what I was going to do living outside of the temple. And it was kind of a nice year for me, actually. I had a really great apartment in Brooklyn in Park Slope, right near the park. And that's when I really actually started getting into yoga, like physical yoga. And it was sort of the beginning of me eventually becoming a yoga teacher, because I really got into a serious yoga practice when I moved out of the temple. I used to go to the park every single morning and I would do yoga in the park. And eventually I kind of spun that into, you know, actually teaching yoga. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. I was thinking maybe I'll open up a recording studio, you know, because I was always really into like, you know, the recording end of stuff, maybe start my own studio. And I was thinking about things like that and things that I could do to actually make money outside of shelter, because we had just gotten dropped and we didn't know what was going to happen with the band.
When did you decide, or when did you and Ray start talking again? When did you decide to, you know, record and write another shelter record?
Well, at this point, I believe that Ray was living in California and I hadn't even seen him for like a year. Like, he moved to California. I didn't really see him that much. A couple of times I went to California and we met up together and it was really nice. He picked me up in his car. We go out to eat and stuff. And at that point there was really like no hard feelings between us. It had been like, you know, months and months, and we had just kind of like, we were over it. You know what I mean? I can't remember the exact circumstances of how 20 Summers Pass came to be. I don't know if it was like interest from record labels. I think maybe like Revelation or maybe like Victory kind of like maybe approached us and said, hey, are you guys still doing music or something? I don't remember exactly how that came about, but I remember like we decided, yeah, we're going to do another record. And it was basically just me and Ray at that point. And so we just got a drummer and we did the record. We got the drummer for his girlfriend's band, Baby Gopal.
Oh, Tree Files.
Yeah, Tree, yeah. And they had just got signed to a major label. And so things were happening for her, ironically. nothing was happening for us, but things were happening for her. But we got the drummer for Baby Gopal. And it was just the three of us did that record.
And you decided, you self-financed it, or the labels financed it, but you decided to go back to Don Fury.
Yes.
Was that like a full unconscious thing, or did you...
Yeah, we were sick of fucking friggin' labels telling us what to do. We were sick, and there was also, it's funny because, Yeah, I was listening to that song. You know, you sent me the whole record, and it's got that bonus track, Yes, I Can. Remember that song, Yes, I Can? That song was originally written for Beyond Planet Earth. There was a huge pressure, no thrash songs on this record, no thrash songs. And even Tom Soares was saying, we got too many thrash songs on this record. We got to cut these faster songs off. It's going to throw off the cohesion of the record. Like, you don't want to have all these hardcore songs on it. You know, we got to slow things down. We got to like get some radio hits on here. If you have too many of these thrash songs, it's not going to balance out right with the record. So Yes, I Can was a song that it was a thrash song and Ray loved it. And then it never even came out on 20 Summers Pass, I don't think. That wasn't on the record, was it?
It was on the European version, the bonus track.
Yeah, it didn't come out on the original one. I don't think I liked it that much. But I think Ray loved it. And it's finally coming out on records like his dream come true. He believed in that song from Beyond Planet Earth days.
If you look back on 20 Summers, the songwriting, obviously, you wrote most of the material at that point on that record.
Yeah.
Like, did you think or were you on a mission to kind of prove or show the true essence of the band? Or what was your motivation? Was it organic or was it kind of reactionary to Beyond Planet Earth as well?
I wasn't on a mission to prove anything to anybody. But I just figured, you know, Shelter's strength wasn't our ability to write the perfect pop song. That wasn't even what our strength was. Even like our poppiest song, Here We Go, it's not like your typical pop song that you hear on the record. It sounds almost like an Oi song to me with all the backup vocals and stuff. So I figured our strength was melodic hardcore. So why not lean into our strength? And like, I was so sick of hearing that we couldn't write any fast songs. We couldn't do any thrash songs. And it was like, no, that's like what we do best. So, you know, that's why the record was pretty fast. And even like the popular songs are pretty fast paced. Like In the Van Again, you know, that maybe are like poppiest song, but you know, it's at a good clip. You know, the beats per minute are actually pretty fast. And I think it's a way more cohesive record than Beyond Planet Earth, for sure. I think it's a way better representation of Shelter just in general as a band.
Mm-hmm. You got Chris Conley from Saves the Day doing backup vocals on that one. What did you know about him and how did he get involved?
Saves the Day weren't even big. Saves the Day weren't big, but we had our roadie, Sean, who has since passed away. It's really sad. He got cancer and passed away way too early. He was our roadie and he was in Saves the Day. He played on the first Saves the Day record. We were in the van one time. It was just me and him. And we were going to pick up some gear. And he goes, hey, you want to hear a record of my band? We got signed to Equal Vision. And I was like, wow, you guys got signed to Equal Vision? And he was like, yeah, check it out. And he put it in there. And I was like, oh my God, your singer. I really honestly dug this stuff. And he played me that first Saves the Day record before anybody had heard it. And I was like, man, your singer is great. He's like, you can't believe this kid. He's 17 years old. He can sing like a bird. He plays guitar. He writes all the songs. He does all the harmonies. And I was like, wow, those harmonies are great. And then that record came out. And at the time, we were recording that record, and I saw Sean. I was like, hey, do you think you can get that kid from your band to come down and sing some harmonies? I really like the harmonies. And they were like, you know, I was sort of oblivious, you know, because I wasn't really like, you know, super into hardcore and like, you know, going to shows all the time anymore. You know, at this point I had a family and, you know, I had a son and stuff like that. So I didn't even know it, but it was really before Saves the Day broke, because it was before their second record came out. You know, just their first record was out. So they were still kind of like a small band. But yeah, he came down. I barely even knew him. I went to one Saves the Day show, but I didn't talk to him. But he came down, and I couldn't believe how young he was, because he was I don't know how old he was, maybe 18 or something, but he looked like he was 14, you know? And he did a great job singing all the harmonies on that record. Because Ray came, did his vocals, and then he had to go back to California. So I was kind of like left to finish the whole record without him. So he didn't really sing a lot of harmonies on the record.
Where was the band spiritually at that point? Because what I noticed at that point also, you started to grow your hair out. There's pictures of you playing on that tour, bleached hair, this hair. And, like, where was the band in terms of, you know, your spirituality? And
it's funny because I remember thinking, like, oh, Raisin Maya. You know, Maya's like one of these Christian things where you say a person's an illusion. You know, they've kind of fallen back into material life. Oh, Raisin Maya, he's out there in California, and he's like, you know, I didn't really even know what he was doing, you know, like I just kind of, you know, probably unfairly judged him, you know, because whatever, he started like, you know, dressing cool and, you know, he had earrings and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just like, it's, you know, you're no longer a monk. And so you got to figure out what's that going to look like in your life. And you still have to, you know, it's a real kind of balancing act, because now not only do you have more freedom that you did when you were, you know, like a full-time spiritual practitioner, you know, that level of really intense spiritual practice isn't even expected of you anymore. So you have a little bit more freedom, but then you also have a lot more of these, just what you people would consider like, you know, mundane responsibilities. You have to pay your bills. You have to pay your rent. You have to take care of things. You own a house now. You know, I had bought a house and I have to pay my mortgage and just stuff like that. So it's a lot of just kind of figuring out what that's going to look like for you. And it's, and what, how that works out for you and how you find balance for you isn't necessarily how it's going to look like for another person. You know, they have a whole different set of circumstances and the way that plays out and the way their spirituality plays out for them. But, you know, when you start to have kids, wow, that's like, especially when your kids are little, that becomes a huge part of your life. And I think it's just like a season of your life where you go through where your really intense spirituality is kind of put on the back burner for a little bit. And it's more like your spirituality becomes, okay, now I have a family to take care of and I have kids to raise. And that's all, and it's not like that's like, I would even consider that a material thing. You know, that's an important, that can be as important to you spiritually as anything. And as a matter of fact, I think that point in my life was actually super spiritual, because, you know, part of Krishna consciousness is you're not in the center. You don't want to put yourself in the center and think that the world revolves around you. And when you're single, I don't care who you are, when you're single and you're just on your own and you have no dependence in your life, it's very easy to fall in that mindset that, you know, it's me at the center and then the outside world is meant to bring things to me. But once you have kids, that's it. Like, you're not at the center. Your kids are at the center. You have to think of, okay, now I have to take care of these kids. And it pulls you right out of that. And so even that is, I consider that like a very kind of spiritual thing to go through, where all of your wants and needs and desires, they're all put on the back burner. I had, you know, I was, just think, like, here I am, I'm like 30 years old. The only thing I had ever done in my life since I was 16 was play in punk rock bands. Try to get a job with that on your resume. 14 years of punk rock and traveling around in a van. Please hire me. Let me tell you, nobody's going to hire you.
Thank you very much for listening to the End Hits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care.